gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Lone Wolf Radio calling. Lone Wolf Radio calling. This is Lone Wolf Radio with your host, Tom Mesger. As they say in Hollywood, it's on with the show.
Boys and girls, it's time to go. It's time to do the show. It's October the 4th, 2017, and it's Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, at P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, 92583. Also, forget that address we had for a while, 1281 North State Street, Suite A, Box 114, San Jacinto, California. Forget that. That box is closed. So if you're sending anything to that box, it's probably going to come back to you. Boys and girls, beware of all the BS on the internet about this Las Vegas thing, because we've got millions of trollers and false flaggers out there spreading all kinds of so-called conspiracy theories. The only thing I've ever found that makes too much sense is you go to the court, federal court, and start looking through the documents after something's over. But it's just coming in here like mad from the right wing. The right wing is just full of these people who spread all kinds of nonsense. Now, some of it could be true, but the problem is there's so much shit flying through the air, you can't keep track of what's true and what's not. And how would you know? How would you know? Well, today we're going to get back to riots, mayhem, bloodshed, and the white working man rising up and kicking ass. I'll bet you only thought that the Aryan Nations existed in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, back in the day. Well, I'll let you know there were mines in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. This is about the Miners' Riot, April 29, 1899. In its earliest days, the mining industry of our country has suffered continuously from labor unrest. Well, that's because they didn't get paid enough wages. The major problems have been two, unionization and wages, and no segment of the industry has been exempt. Coal, iron, copper, lead, zinc, gold, and silver workers have all at one time or another resorted to violence to gain their demands. The frequency of miner strikes may be partially explained by the unusual and hazardous conditions of work. The underground workers, in contrast to surface miners, run great risks to both their safety and their health. Only when unionized have miners been able to improve their wages and working conditions, which proves that violence works sometimes. As in most other industries, the struggle for union recognition has been filled with desperatism, bitterness, hatred, and violence on the part of both owners and workers. The dispute through the two last decades of the 19th century was brought on in part by the unyielding opposition to some mine owners and operators to unionization of their plants and their refusal to discuss the matter with the worker representatives. Union agents were considered mortal enemies of management and dismissed contemptuously as irresponsible troublemakers. Nuisance they were, for their type of local union organization often involved rousing the workers into a frenzy of discontent. And it didn't take too much to do that. The major national miners union was the United Mine Workers of America, formed in 1849. But its activities, particular to coal, was limited to the eastern and central states. Unionization of the miners in the western states was vigorously pressed by the Western Federation of Miners, which had close Socialist Party affiliations. And after the turn of the century was to be connected with the leftist International Workers of the World, the IWW, or the Wobblies. And that's what John Jewell, our writer of such great articles, was a member of and an officer up in Canada of the IWW, which still exists. This union's activities in northwestern Idaho during the 1890s was so violent and disturbing that within 8 years, three successive presidents were called upon by as many worried governors to dispatch United States troops to preserve the peace, in other words, to suppress the workers. Harrison in 1892, Cleveland in 1894, and McKinley in 1899. The mines of Coeur d'Alene District were in the Shoshone County, Idaho, near the northern end of the panhandle of the state. This was one of the richest lead mining regions in the world, the ore carrying considerable silver. Lead was first discovered in the county in 1882. Six shanty towns were strung along the base of the barren mountains. In some there was room for only a single narrow street between the mountains and the deep canyon creeks. The only route in and out were the Northern Pacific and Oregon Railway and Navigation Company railroads. The small mining towns along these railroads from east to west were Mullen, Jim, Burke, Wallace, and Kellogg. A 3 mile spur line led to Wardner. By 1892, quarrels between the operators and their employers were frequent. Efforts of the union to force an increase in the wage level caused the operators to import non-union workers, scabs. The riot in July at Homestead, Pennsylvania, was reported to have encouraged the Coeur d'Alene miners to resort to violence. On July 11th, armed union men attacked the guards and workmen at the Frisco mine in Jim, three of the latter being killed. The mill of the mine was blown up. The governor proclaimed martial law and requested federal troops, who remained in the area until mid-November. More than 300 men were arrested, but none was punished. Small wage increases resulted. Spurred by the Pullman strike 2 years later, Chapter 9, the union members undertook a campaign of intimidation and terrorism. Whoa! 40 masked men shot and killed one of the principal 1892 state witnesses in the Frisco mine case. They kidnapped a mine superintendent and attempted to blow up a mine at Wardner. Federal troops were again summoned and remained for 3 weeks. The policy of harassment on non-union miners continued without interference by the local law officers, and by 1899 the only mine in the district not unionized was that in Bunker Hill and Sullivan Company at Wardner. In April, the employees were met and threatened by armed men and required to join the union. The company then raised the pay to meet the union scale in an effort at the other mines, but refused to recognize the union. This rejection could not be tolerated by the Coeur d'Alene Miners Union, which for many years had fought to prevent the employment of any person other than its members in the regional mines. Bunker Hill and Sullivan was the last holdout. Its operators must be reminded by force, if necessary, that this situation would no longer be tolerated. On the morning of Saturday, April the 29th, which was not a working day, the members of all locals, Mullen, Jim, Burke, and Wardner, met to discuss a course of action, since some blueprint plan was outlined to each group. They simultaneously decided to go to Wardner armed and masked, and unmasked or unmasked according to individual choice. The Mullen members, 200 strong, marched 7 miles west to Wallace, collecting guns and ammunition previously stored at farms along the road. Meanwhile, 200 of the Burke locals seized a Northern Pacific train of 9 freight and ore cars and forced the engineer to proceed at reduced speed. 7 miles farther on at Jim, 150 to 200 men awaited the train. As it stopped, a dozen excited men jumped off and walked a few yards to the storehouse of Helena Fresco Mining Company, threatening the manager, and seized 80 kegs of dynamite, about 3,000 pounds. It was 10:30 when the train reached Wallace, 3 miles beyond, where the waiting Mullen members climbed aboard. The train proceeded another 12 miles to Kellogg, where it was switched to the OR&N Company tracks for the last lap of the journey. The 3 miles to Wardner, about a mile from town, the Wardner members who had left town in groups of 3 to 10 joined their comrades. By that time, about 1 p.m., two-thirds of the total membership, about half of whom were masked and armed with Winchester rifles and pistols. The cars were packed and the men even clung to the engine and the tender. When the Dynamite Express, as the train was later called, stopped at the Wardner station, the previously prepared plan was carried out with military precision. The group at this time was far from being a disorganized mob. The men were lined up and orders shouted, Burke Union to the front, Jim Union to the front, and the same of the others. Each miner wore either a strip of white handkerchief in the buttonhole of his coat or a strip of white cloth tied on his right arm. For nearly an hour, the at-ease men occupied the time by passing around bottles of whiskey while the leaders conferred on the next moves and strategy. This waiting period was the beginning of the transformation of the crowd into a mob, for the individuals united in a single well-defined purpose began to become emboldened and reckless. One and all, they believed that they could destroy the Bunker Hill mine and kill its superintendent, who had acted as a spokesman for the operators with no fear of punishment, that, in short, they could get away with it. This belief was enforced by the fact that the county sheriff, whose pro-union sympathies were well known, was present and was apparently to offer no opposition. In many cases, like in Matuan, too, the big coal miner union wars down in West Virginia, many times the local sheriff sided with the union workers. Yeah. So anyhow, after almost an hour, the boxcar containing... What's wrong here? Boys and girls, I'm rechecking my meters here. I was reading to you and I looked up and they didn't look right. So they look right now, so I'll continue and hope I got I hope I got the first part right. Maybe we shouldn't have shoved Jerry the Jew down a well. He did know something about electronics. Like I said, a lot of sheriffs around the country were sympathetic to the white working man, because they really owed their job to the local voters. But the local voters were split on these subjects too, because many of the people in the community went along with the mine owners and so forth like that. So it was a mixed up deal all the way around. After almost an hour, the boxcar containing the dynamite was opened and the kegs containing a ton and a half of powder were distributed to the various detachments. An advanced armed guard of about 150, hoping to flush out the hated superintendent, riddled the office building with bullets, but he had been forewarned and had escaped. Meanwhile, a small band crept along the creek and fired a few shots at the mine's concentrator, a complicated plant where the waste were removed from the rough ore and probably dumped into a pristine Idaho River. Mistaking them for Bunker Hill men, the main body riddled them with bullets, killing a member of the Burke local named Smythe. I used to go with a girl by the name of Smythe. While one group was spreading the dynamite through the mill and office under the concentrator, another was setting fire to the company's boarding house and bunkhouse, as well as the superintendent's home. The majority of the visitors had marched together from the railroad station to the mine, and they encouraged the active groups with cheers. Soon the cry of fire drove them back to the single main street. Everyone shouted, "Farther back, they're going to put on the show. Out of the way," unquote. The long-awaited moment had arrived. The fuses were ready and the destruction of one of the largest concentrators in the world was about to begin. At 2:26 p.m., the fuses were lighted and the concentrator was blown skyward in pieces, accompanied by a cloud of dust and smoke, and followed by a deafening roar which could be heard 20 miles away. Broken fragments of machinery and timbers from the building were hurled high into the air. 15 seconds later, another blast shattered the office building. From the force of the third, debris was hurled in every direction. I know you're in wild anticipation here. I'm sorry. The work of the destruction was complete. The great Bunker Hill mill, valued at $250,000, was totally destroyed. That would have been a tremendous amount of money in today's inflated currency. As if awed by what they had seen, the watching union members were silent for a few moments. Then almost instantaneously, the crowd transformed into a mob. One and all, they yelled like demons as they gloried in their accomplishment. A celebration was in order, and suddenly those with rifles and revolvers began shooting into the air as they started the short walk back to the train. Unfortunately, two of the union mine workers at the Bunker Hill mine were identified by the Wardner organizer, and the mob moved upon them for the fun of punishment. For over an hour, they were held prisoner. James Cheyenne, a millman, and Roger Rogers, the company's stenographer, forcing them to run on command, kicking them, striking them with guns, and threatening their lives. Finally, as the train whistle signaled the approaching time of departure, they crowned these indignities by ordering their two terrified captors to run and then firing as near to them as possible. As the two stumbled on the run, a hail of bullets surrounded them, some dangerously near to their heels. The aim of some tipsy celebrants was naturally inaccurate, and Roger's lip was torn with a bullet, while Cheyenne was shot in the hip. He lay bleeding on the ground, for anyone attempting to aid him was himself threatened. Finally, a woman defied the attackers and made him comfortable until the attackers went to the station. The fun was over. The jubilation was somewhat dampened when the body of their fellow member, Smythe, was brought down from the mountainside and placed in a baggage car. But of course it was understood by everyone that the shooting was accidental, though regrettable, and the train began to return trip. That's what we called friendly fire back in the 1800s. But about half a mile from the Wardner, someone discovered that some 75 men had been left behind, so the train backed up for them. The passengers were dropped off at their home stations. By 5 o'clock, the train was at Burke, its starting point, and the local men removed Smythe's body. The day had been an unqualified success. The destruction had proceeded according to schedule, and the Bunker Hill operators had been given to understand that if they rebuilt the recommenced operations, they would be wise to recognize the Union. This is quite understandable as a tactic. It's the only way that the system understands anything, because it's so locked in with the corruption and crooked people at the top that there's no other way to deal with them. In the end, it has to come down to this. It's guerrilla warfare. And anything in between, you know, all your petitions and all your meetings and all your rallies mean nothing. Because in the end, it has to come down to blood. It's just the way it is. Your enemy has too much power, and they're not going to leave go of it without a big fight. And it's coming. It's coming, but it's not going to just come from the white separatists. It's going to come from blacks. It's going to come from Hispanics and mestizos and even some Asians. It's not going to be just one situation. Now, when the dust clears, it's going to be interesting to see who's on top or whether it can be worked out in an amiable fashion to split it up. But that's not for us. That's down the line. We're doing our part right now by keeping it alive. Repercussions were immediate. By evening, Idaho Governor Frank Studenberg appealed to President McKinley for federal troops. Now, of course, you understand this is not just to stop violence. This is to back up the mine owners, the rich mine owners. Since most of the state's National Guard forces were in the Philippines, you see, lots of working men were shoved down to the Philippines to fight the Hucks. And the Hucks were the native Filipinos, and that's where they developed the .45 automatic, was for use in the Philippines. Because a .38 would not drop these guys, because these Hucks would, I'm going to be a little crude here, they used to wrap a cord around their nutsack, squeeze it tight, and they would charge the lines of the opposition after taking narcotics and so forth, and no .38 could bring them down. So they had to develop a .45 automatic that would knock a guy down even if you hit him in the hand. That's why I'll never get rid of my .45. But anyhow, here's all these Americans down there. What were they fighting for in the Philippines? Well, the corporate people were exploiting the people of the Philippines for sugar or whatever it was. And when they balk, their form of separatism, and I'm not saying one side or the other is totally good or bad, but this happens, and then the corporations will send in the troops, you know, to safeguard their extraction of the wealth of the country. So whenever there's a uprising of people in a country, instead of sending troops there, as far as we're concerned, we should support it. Anyhow, within 3 days, 500 soldiers were in the area. On May 3rd, the governor declared martial law in Shoshone County. Now began the task of arresting those involved in the incident. Many were able to escape to Montana, but the soldiers and local deputies visiting each mining camp were able to round up more than 700 who were held in military custody for pretrial hearings. You see how that's the way it works. The first few hundred were jailed in a large hay warehouse. Those arrested later were held in boxcars. The number finally held for the trial were about 500. The coroner's jury laboriously examined hundreds of witnesses, focusing on two murders. Cheyenne died on May 2nd under riotous conditions, rather than blowing up the mine. Honest testimony was difficult to obtain because of widespread fear, and therefore only the principal offenders were eventually brought to trial. Most of the union leaders fled from the state, and one organizer arrested was tried for conspiracy and murder and sentenced to imprisonment for 17 years. 13 miners were also tried and 10 found guilty, serving short sentences. But a short sentence back in those days, it's getting that way now, but a short sentence back in those days was really horrible, you know, breaking up rocks and so forth. The prisons were terrible dungeons. 13 miners were also tried and 10 found guilty, serving short terms. The federal troops remained in the area until the end of October. The uprising in April 29, 1899 gained nothing for the local of the Western Federation of Miners. Under state supervision, the operators of the mines in Coeur d'Alene District banded together to screen all union workers so that those involved in any way were required to obtain work permits when the mines reopened 10 days after the explosion. You see how this stuff goes? It's a continual warfare. It's continual war. Each man appeared before state agents and signed an application form which called for an answer to specific questions. Quote, I did not participate actively or otherwise in the April 29th riots, believing that the crimes committed at Wardner were actively incited, encouraged, and perpetrated through by and means of influence and direction of the miners' union. I hereby express my unqualified disapproval of said acts, and hereby renounce and forever abjure all allegiance to said coal miners' union. In other words, you had to betray your own people, of which I was a former member, and I solemnly pledge myself to obey the law and not again to seek membership in any society which will encourage or tolerate any violation of the law. Well, you better not run for Congress or Senate or President, because that's exactly what they do. Non-union members signed an application form stating that they had not participated in the Wardner violence. The reign of intimidation and terror was temporarily ended, at least on one side, but it didn't stop on the other side, on the ruling class. They can perpetuate that stuff and send out the military anytime they want to, like they did in Arizona when they machine gunned down the strikers silver mines in Arizona, was it, or copper mines? Men, women, and children. However, so implacable and bitter was the feeling of the Western Federation against Governor Sternberg, who continued his crackdown on miner strikes during the remaining years of his administration. He was a lackey for the mine owners, that in December 1905 he was killed by a bomb thrown by a professional assassin hired by the Federation. See, these boys had it together, man. This was back when the white guys had it together. A hell of a lot better than they do now. The Shoshone County Sheriff, who had openly aided the union members and looked the other way, was removed from office, as were county commissioners. A full-scale investigation by the Military Affairs Committee of the United States House of Representatives in 1900 endorsed the actions of President McKinley and Governor Sternberg and approved the conduct of the troops during their long period of duty in Coeur d'Alene District, no matter what they did. Yeah, guess who's in charge, boys and girls? The guy who signs the check. Coeur d'Alene was only one of the riot-torn strikes of miners in a long fight for union recognition. Two of the most bitter involved coal miners in Illinois and Kentucky. At Huron, Illinois, in 1922, riotous violence during a strike cost 36 lives. They didn't play around back then, 21 of them non-union miners. For two decades before unionization in 1941, the coal miners at Harlan County, Kentucky, remember Harlan County, Kentucky? That's a great TV series, you ought to watch it, engaged in bitter strife with operators. So frequent were the outbreaks that the county gained the nickname Bloody Harlan. Riots by coal miners were reduced when the majority of operators recognized the United Mine Workers of America in 1890. You see? It took a lot of violence to get it. John L. Lewis was its president for 40 years, from 1920 to 1960. And I remember very well as a young kid watching the war between John L. Lewis and Harry Truman. And John L. Lewis was one mean bastard. Boy, he came out of the ranks of the miners. He was a great big man with big bushy eyebrows. And the Republican newspapers used to picture him in cartoon form as being, you know, this horrible giant monster. I remember that. But John L. Lewis didn't give a shit. He took on Harry and the Congress and the Senate and everybody else. Truman was trying to use the fact that we were in the Korean War, and so any kind of union stop work stoppage was going against the national interests of the country. Well, like we're not at war most of the time, you know. You can use that excuse anytime. Anytime. Just remember, Harry Truman was a little fucking haberdasher. He owned a clothing store in Kansas City. Like I've told you many times, he was a con from the Jew Pendergast machine who put him in office. And then he's telling all these white workers what to do. Those Puerto Ricans, I believe it was the Puerto Ricans that tried to take Harry Truman out. They infiltrated the Congress or went into the Congress and let go with a bunch of shots at him and missed him or missed somebody, but they were after him. And they wanted Puerto Rican independence. We should have gave it to them. I'm for all these people having their independence. Screw it. Because it's just used as a front for the capitalists to go in and rob the people of their goodies. And now that island of Puerto Rico was so corrupt and so far in debt due to corruption and maintenance by the capitalists on the mainland and like that now they don't have any money or anything or any credit or anything to rebuild their island, you know. So guess where they're going to go? Oh, you guessed it. Good old USA. Zionist USA. Not I got you all excited. But that's a glimpse of what the generations past have been, the kind of men, the white men that didn't take that crap and they rose up and did what they had to do. It's not the kind of people we got today, because, or even our last generation, because our last couple of generations, they funneled their fury over to other countries to kill other people. not to rise up here and straighten things out. Well, let's go on to another favorite of mine, Race Riot East St. Louis, Illinois, July 2, 1917. The largest racial minority in the United States, the Negroes, have been most persecuted, oh boy, by their white fellow citizens. Forget that. I get sick and tired of hearing that. Most of all, these black fellow citizens have been brutalized by the power, money power, and wage slavery and like that. Not the white working man. He just wants physical separation and social separation. Many times since the Civil War, the most hideous and shocking of all outbreaks of mob violence, lynching, and the race riot have been Negroes, have made Negroes their victim. Well, if they were guilty, they should hang. Lynching, fine. That's a reasonable, natural thing to do. So, and also, it created enough fear to keep the races separated as much as possible, even with Jim Crow, which was an attempt at a bad situation of separation. You cannot have two races living side by side without them mixing. And you can't have them living side by side and not have what's happening today. You have to have total geographical separation. And the leaders of this country never wanted that because they were making too much money off cheap labor. So they wanted to keep the nigger boys. And I think most black separatists, black nationalists, understand that and understand what we're talking about, and we understand what they're talking about. Lynchings of individual Negroes since 1900 have totaled about 1,800, but have become less and less frequent in recent years. I want to remind you one thing. The records on lynchings show that there was actually one, during the same period of time, there was one more white person that was lynched than blacks. So this idea that it's all blacks being lynched, most of the whites being lynched, were on the West Coast among the miners. Yeah, vigilante committees. None were reported in 1960 and 62, and only one in 1961. Well, that's because they had federal troops on every corner. The term lynching derived from the acts of Judge Charles Lynch, a Virginia Justice of the Peace, who during the American Revolution in the 1780s caused British loyalists to be flogged without giving them recourse and due process of law. In present usage, lynching is defined as punishment meted out to individuals by unauthorized groups acting outside the law. Actually, lynching means taking a accused person from the control of a law, duly authorized law official, is what it really means. The punishment has almost always been hanging. Lynching was the punishment most often meted out to lawbreakers in the United States frontier communities before regular constituted law forces were in control. Well, if they'd have had an electric chair, they'd have done that too. They'd have taken an electric chair from town to town and electrocuted people. But at the time, they only had rope and trees to hang the rope on. The most famous use of lynching in the West was by the vigilantes of San Francisco in the 1850s that I just mentioned. The victims of these frontier lynching were mostly white. The Negro lynching party was a small-scale riot in which the victim is prey of a group too small in number to be called a mob, since the word implies a crowd, yet in action has all the characteristics of a mob. Lynching have been very often been part of the larger race riots. Deep-seated animosities against non-whites and vice versa have caused other minority groups of foreign birth or heritage to suffer from mob action. See, people want separation. They want tribalism. They want to live around the people they like to live around. And the job of the other side is to shove people together, shove no matter what they want, shove them together so people react and they kill people. What do you expect? An example of the anti-Chinese feeling of the Pacific Coast is narrated in Chapter 7, which I've already read to you. A legacy of days of the Spanish California was enmity towards the Mexicans. That's the mestizos, not Hispanics. Their lot as migrant laborers has been unhappy. In at least one serious riot in wartime Los Angeles in 1943, they, together with Negroes, were the targets of violence by servicemen because of their unique ducktail haircuts and exaggerated clothing, fingertip-length coats, peg-leg trousers, and wide-brimmed hats. The avowed purpose was to show that the Zoot Suiters show the Zoot Suiters their place. Well, the Zoot Suiters were very powerful at the time. They were big, like these big black gangs and stuff like that. So, and they were pushing their weight around L.A. and grabbing a lot of white women. So when the white troops come back from overseas, they saw this on the streets and they got pissed off and rose up. And the antagonists in a race riot are usually aroused by a rumor or an incident that serves to release long repressed hatreds. Long repressed hatreds, remember that. And resentments release is found in comparative anonymity of a mob. And a, you know, when I say long repressed hatreds, well, that's the Watts riots, when the whole riot started because a cop gave a black woman a traffic ticket on a hot night in Watts. It doesn't take much to kick it off, and that's why it keeps the government scared all the time. It could be that way now, and it's getting to be that way now. The only thing is, the only ones rioting, are mostly blacks and white Marxists. But if the white working class or the people who generally supported Trump ever get pissed off enough and rise up, watch out. You better head for high, tall timber. The attackers in 1917 outbreak in East St. Louis, Illinois, committed acts of barbarity and savage unmatched in other race riots. Well, that's because when the white man really gets pissed off, he's the most brutal son of a bitch on the face of the earth. He's the Russian bear. No quarter, no quarter. It takes him a long time to get to that point, but when he gets there, you better get it there, get out of the way. For East St. Louis represents the early 20th century's peak of anti-Negro violence and brutality. Well, they take your job, the white workers, just get it up to here, get pissed off. In 1917, East St. Louis, across the Mississippi River from St. Louis, Missouri, was a railroad and industrial center. 27 rail lines passed through or terminated in the city, and the major industries included the large stockyards and meat packing plants of three major companies, and huge works of the Aluminum Ore Company and the American Steel Company. East St. Louis profited from the wartime economy. See? A lot of money's made in war. And that's why we have war. It's usually not protecting your national borders. It's usually money. And the continual need for more and more workers was responsible for the growth in the Negro population from 6,000 of a 59,000 total in 1910 to 13,000 of 70,000 in 1917. More than 2,000 Southern Negroes arrived in the year before the riot, you see. White people began to see that and began to get pissed off, and they were ready for it. All it takes is a hot night and a few drinks. This influx was a result of labor needs. No, capitalist needs, big business needs, and cheap labor needs, and the anti-unionism of major industries. Negro workers had been recruited and imported in large numbers to replace strikers at the packing and aluminum plants. And what was the aluminum needed for? Warplanes, more for war. Rumors that thousands more were to be imported caused resentment and a call for action barring further Negro migration. But you think that happened? No. In an open meeting before the city, in fact, these big shots capitalists, they don't give a shit how many Negroes die unless it causes a problem for them making profits. If it screws, if it really helped their profits, they'd be for segregation. In an open meeting before the city council of this evening of May 28th, labor leaders harangued an overflow crowd with inflammatory speeches, planting seeds of fear that their job security would be further threatened. Of course it would. No argument about that. The crowd was restless, and according to the pattern of riots, needed only a rumor or an incident to release its hatred and resentments. A rumor was not long in coming. As a group left City Hall, someone reported that a Negro had shot a white man in a holdup. As the story spread, new rumors and elaborations were added, all involving white girls and women. Well, that's always going on. Negroes are always screwing around. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You just look at the archives of the newspapers in the country and see that. A favorite device guaranteed to excite even the most latent anti-Negro feelings. Well, a lot of times these were rumors, and most times they weren't rumors. And that was back when white men got infuriated with a nigger doing anything to a white woman. Within a short time, more than 3,000 persons had rushed downtown with the common intention of beating every Negro unfortunate enough to be in the area. After beating and kicking scores of victims, the persecutors destroyed a few of the saloons and businesses catered to by Negroes. Though two or three Negroes were shot and many beaten, no one was killed. The attacks might have continued the next day had not several companies of the Illinois National Guard arrived in response to the pleas of panic-stricken mayor. Even so, a good many colored citizens were assaulted. The understaff, and this is the sin of integration. This is the sin of cohabitation. This is the sin. It will cause explosions from time to time, and sometimes super major explosions. So the powers that be set this up, really. And then when it happens, they claim, oh, those terrible white working people, they're hurting Negroes. The biggest enemy the Negro has is the white capitalist and his Jew buddies. The understaffed local police force proved to be anti-Negro. The mayor hesitant about taking decisive action against the white workers who had elected him. This minor race riot was unfortunately not followed by any actions which might have relieved the tense situation. The cauldron of prejudice was simmering and inevitably would boil over. The incident that led to the July riot followed the usual pattern of a clash between Negroes and police. Since the May outbreak, of the beatings of Negroes had continued unchecked. Rumor stated that in East St. Louis, Negroes were biding their time until July 4th, when they would rise up against whites. Conversely, the same rumor was circulated by Negroes and whites. It might maintain its maintenance were planning an all-out attack. And it's not necessarily a rumor. It could have been hard, cold facts. In this atmosphere of mutual suspicion, a Negro shot his white attacker on the night of July 1st. A number of vengeful whites in a Ford automobile fired shots into Negro homes, and on the second trip, the fire was returned. when a police car, also a Ford, was sent to the spot to investigate, the Negroes again opened fire, killing one detective instantly and wounding a second so seriously he died the next day. The murders were undoubtedly the result of mistaken identity, the two Fords and their occupants appearing the same in the darkness, but this mattered little at the time. This time the mayor was wise enough to call for the aid of the state militia forces, also working for the system and system money barons. The next morning, Monday, July 2nd, 1917, the bullet-marked Ford, its blood-stained interior, a vivid proof of the night's tragedy, was placed on exhibit in front of the main police station. Speakers at a hurriedly called early morning meeting urged all worthy citizens to arm themselves for the afternoon action. Then they marched to the central part of the city and set the riot in motion by shooting the first Negro. In view of hundreds of white spectators who were themselves either too frightened or to interfere or frankly sympathetic to the actions of the white attackers, the rioters, at that time only small separate bands, followed a half-mile path of terror en route to the segregated Negro district, stoning and clubbing any man or woman or child of color. Well, this is another thing, you know. Once a racial thing starts, all these people, these liberal people that may want to do something to stop it are not going to be able to stop it. They're just going to have to stand back, and they won't have the balls to do anything, which is good. The lack of interference and the apparent support of citizen bystanders encouraged increasingly vicious acts. In the early afternoon, several Negroes who had already been beaten and lay on the ground unconscious were shot and killed. Dozens of Negro women were kicked by white women who beat them continuously with fists, stones, and sticks. The mid-afternoon focus of the rioters was the scene of a May riot. The shacks of poorer Negroes who lived there were surrounded and set fire. Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, they started the wrong end on this stuff. I mean, because I know we realize the difference between what we want and what they want, but burning out the Negroes in their shacks, you see, that I think is wrong, and it should have started at the top. Maybe burn the governor's house down. The incendiary discovered the monstrous fun of shooting the residents as they appeared through smoke and flames. This game was described by a St. Louis reporter. Quote, a crazed Negro would dash from his burning home, sometimes with a revolver in hand. Immediately, revolvers by the score would be fired. He would zigzag through the spaces between the buildings. Then a well-directed shot would strike him, and he would leap into the air. There were deep shouts intermingled with shrill feminine ones. The flames would creep to the body. The Negro would writhe, attempting to get up. More shots would be fired. The flames would eat their way to and past him. Thus, integration. Thus, two workforces at war. Thus, separation is the only way it'll ever work. The climax of the riot was reached during the early evening. By that time, scores of Negro homes lay in ashes. Yet the mob continued this game of burning and nigger hunting with undiminished glee. The hoses of fire department were cut by axes and rendered useless. At least half a dozen children or seriously wounded men were hurled into the flames to be burned to a crisp. In one case, a witness testified a little 10-year-old boy whose mother had been shot down was running around sobbing and looking for her. Some members of the mob shot the boy, and before life had passed from his body, they picked up the little fellow up and threw him in the flames. In another incident, a colored woman with a little 2-year-old baby in her arms was trying to protect the child, and they shot her and also shot the child. And threw them into the fire. Thus integration. Thus murders were not rumors, unbelievable enough. They took place only 50 years ago from the time this book was printed. The berserk whites, no. The racially conscious whites that had a gripe. They didn't want to have blacks around. They wanted them separate. Didn't want them living in the same town. They didn't want them living in the same block. But the powers that control the money and so forth and politics of the country said, we don't give a shit what you want, white man. Well, white men now, in this particular case, are saying, we don't give a shit what you want. We're going to have a riot. The berserk whites even attempted lynching, several of which were successful. The explanation was made that southern niggers deserve a genuine lynching. There was thousands and thousands of Negroes come out of the South, you see, after the Civil War. They traded in chattel slavery and became wage slaves, and also to debase the wages of the white working class. A reporter described the hanging of a Negro whose head had been smashed open by clubs and who lay bloody, unconscious, and near death, as if that never happened to white people at the hands of a Negro. I saw the most sickening incident of the evening when they got stronger rope to put the rope around a Negro's neck. One of the lynchers stuck his fingers inside the gaping scalp and lifted the Negro's head by it, literally bathing his hand in the man's blood. Quote, get hold and pull for East St. Louis, called the man as he seized the other end of the rope. The Negro was lifted to a height of about 7 feet and the body left hanging there for hours. More soldiers arrived during the evening, and in many cases the activities of the rioters were restrained by their presence. On the other hand, abundant later testimony indicated that the guardsmen often participated in the attacks rather than preventing them. One of the deplorable aspects of the riot was that the majority of both local policemen and Illinois guardsmen were sympathetic to the rioters, and several times they refused pleas for help and actually shot Negroes for no apparent reason other than their own bias. The burning continued throughout the night, and the flames could be seen many miles away. The toll for the evening was more than 200 houses reduced to ashes and a completely burnt out 16-block area. Officials figure for buildings totaling destroyed during the 24-hour period was 312 buildings. As in almost all riots, the immediate reports of casualties were grossly exaggerated. I have workmen outside my domain here today, so you're going to hear somebody pounding. Sorry. Biasing headlines throughout the United States gave the number of Negro dead as from 100 to 400. The front page of the St. Louis Globe Democrat of July 3rd was topped by the bold letters, quote, 100 Negroes shot, burned, clubbed to death in East St. Louis race war, unquote. The East St. Louis Police Department estimated an official figure, both Negroes and whites, as 100. The Congressional Investigating Committee, indicated that an exact figure was impossible to determine, but fixed the toll of dead as 8 whites and 39 Negroes. Hundreds of Negroes were wounded and hundreds left, and the city never returned. The riot was studied in detail in 3 special investigations: a local St. Clair County grand jury, a board of inquiry of the Illinois National Guard, and a special committee of the United States House of Representatives. Published versions of the hearings, however, were abridged and therefore appear to have omitted unpleasant testimony. The state's attorney in St. Clair County claimed that he could prosecute no one because he was unable to find a single person who witnessed any citizens committing violence on July 2nd. Nevertheless, a grand jury drew up indictments against 82 whites and 33 Negroes. Trials on the charges of assault with intent to murder and conspiracy to riot resulted in 21 prison sentences, 9 whites and 12 Negroes. This was admittedly a somewhat puzzling situation since only 4 of the imprisoned whites were tried for homicide, though 39 Negroes were murdered, while 11 Negroes were sentenced for the killing of 2 detectives. The light penalties of whites who pleaded guilty to a lesser charge were imposed without trial since no witnesses came forth to testify. That was back when whites stuck together like they did down south. Thus, Negroes continued to be the victims of discrimination even in the law courts. And of course, we admit it. We're racist. We're not going to change. A lot of people think they've changed, but with things getting tight around the country and things breaking out here and there, you're going to see them revert back to racism. In the court of public opinion and in the congressional investigation, East St. Louis and its riotous citizens were strongly condemned. The city government, the employers, the labor organizers, the politicians were charged with conditions which produced the riots. Huh. No, it was the federal government. The whole Civil War thing that screwed everything up and the lack of inclination to send the blacks back to Africa, at least after the Civil War. But we didn't want to do that. Did we want to do that? The rich guys wanted to make cheap labor, cheap labor. Screw the wages for the white man in Detroit and all around. The machinations of political power and the open partiality of the law from detention and arrest to trial were openly exposed. That's the confusion that happens when you have racists living side by side. It just doesn't work over a long period of time. Just like democracy doesn't really work at all. The number of race riots before the present century has never been completely established, but when American Negro attempted to find its place in an overwhelming white society, clashes became inevitable. Well, there's your clue right there from this book. In a study of racial tensions, Professor Alan Grimshaw of Indiana University identifies the 33 major interracial disturbances in the United States between 1900 and 1949. 18 of these occurred between 1915 and 1919, the period of the First World War. See, war brings on all kinds of shit. 5 major riots took place between 1940 and 1944, but only one, Detroit in 1943, was as violent as those of the previous period. Dr. Grimshaw's study does not include the 1950s and 60s with their serious race riots. At least 2 other race riots, though not matching it, approached that of the East St. Louis in scope of ferocity. In Chicago, the 13-day riot in July 1919 took a toll of 38 persons killed, 15 whites and 23 Negroes, 537 injured, 178 whites, 342 Negroes, and 17 unidentified race. More than 1,000 families, mostly Negroes, were left without homes as a result of the burning destruction. The riot began when a Negro swimmer drifted into the water of a segregated beach. A 3rd major riot was in Detroit in June 1943, where 25 Negroes and 9 whites died. At least 700 persons were injured. The outbreak began with a fistfight between a white man and a Negro. Most of the race riots in northern cities through the 1940s resulted from identical underlying causes, according to Dr. Grimshaw. Quote, threats of security of whites brought on by Negroes' gains in economic, political, and social status. Well, of course, Why wouldn't that bring on resentment and hatred? Negro resentment of the attempts to kick him back into his place, and the weakness of the local city government, particularly the police department. Not to kick him back into his place, but go back to racial separation, which is the only way to solve the problem. Now when they teach this stuff in school and universities, it's all the white man, all the white man. But why the white man? They don't want to teach why the white man. They think it's a sin and bad news for a white man to stand up for a territory and not want it invaded by other people of other races. And they keep grabbing onto this everybody's equal bullshit, which is entirely a lie, the lie of the century or the lie of many centuries. And as long as people believe that shit and borrow it from Christianity and so forth, we're going to be screwed. And that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with you on Thursday for another, we'll try to find some more riots.